Well, good evening. We are glad for you to join us this evening as we are picking up our auditorium class that we are in at Pepper Road. We've been studying the period of time from Judah alone after the divided kingdom, after the northern kingdom was taken away into captivity, all the way to the period of silence. And so we are near the end, or nearing the point of the period of silence. We have a couple more stories to tell before we get to that point. And so we're going to be picking up this evening in the book of Nehemiah. We've got three of our members here with us this evening. Jason Strickland. Jason, you want to wave at everybody there so they know who you are?
Good evening, everyone.
We've got Travis Pyle.
Hey, everybody.
And we have one of our deacons, Trevor Bowen, with us.
Hey, everyone.
I appreciate these guys joining us this evening as we get into this study, and looking forward to having you with us. If you want to join in with the conversation, we welcome your comments on our YouTube stream. For our members, you're also welcome to send us an email, and we can try to respond to those as well. Before we get into the book of Nehemiah, I just kind of want to bring everyone up to speed, because I know some of you haven't been in our auditorium class. Of course, if you're not a member at Pepper Road, you certainly haven't. But even some of our members have been in other Bible classes, and so kind of let you know where we're at right now. So this is a timeline that we've been using. And as we began our study, we began back here during the Assyrian Empire. And the Assyrian Empire is the one who took Israel away into captivity. And that was during the time of Hezekiah. A little bit later, Hezekiah's grandson Josiah comes to the throne, and that's where this timeline picks up. And he is the last good king of the southern kingdom. We have a few more kings after Josiah. And in the reign of Jehoiakim, which is Josiah's grandson, we have, during the reign of Jehoiakim, we have the first wave of captivity. So Babylon comes and they take a wave of captivity. They take Daniel and his friends. And so we see from the book of Daniel what happens there with Daniel and his friends. Second wave of captivity, here in 597 BC, they come and they take away Ezekiel and sort of the middle class of Judah. And they are taken over to the river Kibar, and they are kept there. And we read about that, of course, in the book of Ezekiel. And then finally, in around 586 BC, Babylon comes and they destroy Jerusalem. And we read about that in a couple of places. But, of course, Jeremiah is still there in the land when they come and destroy Jerusalem. Beginning back at the first wave of captivity, there's a timeline that starts that Jeremiah gives us. And that timeline is 70 years. The people will be captive for 70 years. And so we move forward for 70 years. And at the end of that 70 years is the end of the Babylonian Empire. The Medo-Persian Empire is the one that comes to power next, the Medo-Persian Empire. And we're told about that also in the book of Daniel. Daniel survives that entire period of captivity. And towards the end of his life, the Medo-Persians come in, and there's a decree made by the king Cyrus to go home and rebuild. That would be the first wave. We have three waves of captivity going into captivity. Then we have three waves coming out of captivity. The first wave coming out of captivity is recorded for us by Ezra. And so as we begin reading the first few chapters of Ezra, we see Zerubbabel and Jeshua leading a number of people back to go and rebuild the temple. They start in on that project, and they complete the foundation, but then work stops. And after work stops, it stops for quite a while, and we have a couple of prophets who come and motivate the people to get started rebuilding again. And that is Haggai and Zechariah. And we've already looked at those prophets in our Bible class. And so Haggai and Zechariah motivate the people to get started again rebuilding. And so in 516 BC, the temple is rebuilt. And so that's kind of the end of the first wave of the return, we might say. The second wave of return comes after the book of Esther. So Esther falls in between that first and second wave of return, and we studied about her in our last Bible class, or Bible class before last. The second wave of return is led by Ezra himself. He tells us about the first wave of return, which comes about, let's see, that is about 80 years. No, let's see, 50, 60, 70. Yeah, about 70 to 80 years before Ezra is when that first return starts. And so he tells us about that kind of as a historical narrative. And then about halfway the book, through the book, he says, this is the return that I led. His return came back to restore the worship. So the first wave is to come back and rebuild the temple. Ezra comes back to restore the worship of the people. And then finally, we come to Nehemiah, who we are looking at tonight. And in his return, he comes back to rebuild the walls. And we're going to see how he goes about that. We're going to see what all is involved. And that's a very inspiring story. A lot of encouragement in the book of Nehemiah. And so it's a really great story that deserves more attention than we're going to give it this evening. We're going to cover 13 chapters, in the time we have remaining. And so obviously that won't be a comprehensive study, but we'll try to get a good sense of what happens and what goes on during that period. All right. That brings us then to the text. And, as we come back now, looking at the book of Nehemiah, we see he is in position in a very, prominent position in the kingdom of the Medo-Persians. And, as he is serving the king as cupbearer, the king, who seems to like Nehemiah, notices that Nehemiah is distraught. And what Nehemiah ends up telling him is that he wants to go home. And Jason, can you tell us a little bit about what is it that provoked that sort of sadness and that desire for him to go back home?
Yeah, as you mentioned there, he is in that prominent position. And I think that is interesting because there's also other characters of the Bible that were in prominent positions. So Nehemiah is also in one of those prominent positions, but he is there with the king as his cupbearer, and Hanani and some other of the men from Judah came there to where Nehemiah was in Susa, and Nehemiah asked them concerning of the conditions there back in Jerusalem and of the Jews there, and the answer, as you already alluded to, it devastated Nehemiah. They told him that the ones that were there were in great distress, and that the walls and the gates were still in disrepair. Obviously, it seems that that they had still laid in disrepair from the time of Nebuchadnezzar and Nebuzaradan when they tore the walls down, that we see from 2 Kings 25 and from Jeremiah 52. And so they still lay in ruins, and this just, it bothers him so much. You can see from chapter 1, starting in verse 4, it says that he wept and mourned for days and fasted, and he prayed before God. And I think from that example, that's something we can surely take from Nehemiah.
It is trying to pull it back up on YouTube, so give us just a moment here. All right, it's coming back. All right. Sorry about that. The internet connection went down where we're broadcasting at. So I know you lost a little bit of that, but, I'm going to give Jason just a moment to kind of tie in, what all he was saying there about the motivations of Nehemiah. So back to you, Jason.
I said, I'm not exactly sure where you lost me, but the tie in there is actually, he was devastated from Hanani and his, what the ones had told him about the walls and their conditions. And basically he goes to the king there, and his countenance obviously was something that had was not normal before the king. And there in chapter 2, he tells the king, after he is asked what the sadness on your face is, why is your face sad? And he said, there's nothing but sadness of heart. He tells him there that he wants to go back, beginning there's nothing sadness of heart in verse 2. Then I was much afraid. I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city and the place of my father's tombs lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire? Then the king said to me, What would you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. Again, this is Nehemiah praying to God. Even in this quick moment of a request, he offers a prayer. And he said to the king, if it please the king and your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah and to the city of my father's tombs that I may rebuild it.
Yeah. Yeah. So the word comes from the city. The city is still in ruins. And as you pointed out, all the way back from the destruction, 140 years, that the walls have been lying in ruins. And it is devastating. The king responds very favorably. It's interesting. I think we see a pattern, in each of the returns. You know, it's not just that the people are allowed to go, but they are, given really enthusiastic blessings from each of the leaders, whether it's all the way back with Cyrus or as we move forward with Ezra and now with Nehemiah. In each case, I think we see God's providence really in sort of as the Proverbs points out, guiding that river, that stream of the heart of the kings and putting them on Israel's side, Judah's side, to continue the work that God wants them to be doing. So Nehemiah is able to leave the king's presence there and to go back to his homeland. And it seems like when he gets there, there's no governor. And so he takes up that role. He as we'll see continuing throughout the story, he takes up the role of governor. And when he arrives there, Trevor, what is, you know, what's his first order of business?
Well, a little bit of time passes, and I think that's interesting. It talks about him staying there for 3 days, and then he gets up in the middle of the night and taking hardly anybody with him, just a few men, and only just this one horse or a donkey that he's riding on. Maybe it's a camel, but a beast with him. And he goes and he surveys the walls. So he wants to see the damage that's done and what is the state of the walls. And we're told that there's places where it's broken down so bad that there's not even room for him to ride his horse through, that he has to get off and work his way through and around the wall to get up to a position where he can see how much damage there is and what is the condition of the walls. And when he does this, nobody really knows exactly why he's there yet. He hasn't disclosed to anybody what his intentions are. And once he goes and then he surveys the walls, then he tells the leaders and the priest and all the elders that, look, and here, I'll just read here from chapter 2. He says to them in 2:17, you see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies in waste and its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach. And I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also the king's words that he had spoken to me. So they said, let us rise up and build. Then they set their hands to this good work. So even though this was something that had fallen into disrepair, and even though Nehemiah shows maybe some concern for whether or not this would be received well, ultimately the people are very glad to join in this work, and they're very excited about doing that. And I'd just like to say that I think Nehemiah shows quite a bit of wisdom in this case, where he doesn't just jump right into things and without, you know, hearing just kind of one side of the story. He takes time to see what are the conditions, to survey the walls for himself. And I think that's a good example and some good wisdom that whenever we're brought into a very difficult or a challenging case, make sure that we take time to survey and see everything so that we understand the true condition of things.
Yeah. And I think it is, like you said, it's worth noting also how he brings the others in. He sort of like presents it to them. Here's the situation. You know, they knew what the situation was, but he sort of presents it to them like, you know, and I think what it also illustrates when you see their reaction, what they needed was a leader. You know, they didn't like the situation any more than he did, but maybe there was just nobody to bring them together and say, okay, let's do something about it. And of course, we're going to see how effective it is when they do decide to do something about it. Now, they're not without opposition. In spite of the zeal of the people, there are some old rivals that are still on the table. Maybe not these specific men, but they come from nations of old rivals. And so, Travis, tell us about the leaders of the opposition.
Yeah, sure. So as we see a little bit of the introductory introduction of Sanballat and the Horonite and Tobiah, the servant there in verse 10 of chapter 2, we get a brush of their character right there that when they heard about Nehemiah's plans, right, it grieved them exceedingly that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. So we already start to see the character of those men. And then in verse 19, we get a little bit more picture of those leaders of the opposition, Sanballat, again, the Horonite or the Moabite, Tobiah the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arabian. Later on, Geshem's name, is Gashmu. It's mentioned as Gashmu. So Sanballat was in a place of authority in Samaria. And we see a connection there later on that with the Jews, that one of Sanballat's daughters actually marries a grandson of Eliashib, who is a high priest. And we see what happens to that individual later on in the story. Now, Tobiah the Ammonite could, possibly a high-ranking official. He's called here a servant, and it's really, as we see the story play out, it's ironic after all of his vain attempts, of trying to stop the rebuild, that he finds himself in a nice spot, a nice condition there in the house of God until Nehemiah comes back and deals with that situation. And then Geshem the Arabian, possibly a chief of the Arabs somewhere south of the Palestine, south of Palestine region there. And just a little bit more into the names, doing a little bit of research of Geshem, that meaning of rainstorm, Tobiah, goodness of Jehovah, and Sanballat, it was mentioned that it was sin has begotten. So interesting history behind those names as well.
Yeah.
Between these leaders of the opposition that we have here of Nehemiah.
Yeah, and one of the things about they're all competitors. Samaria does not want Judah. Come, it's even possible, you mentioned it, a high-ranking official there with Sanballat. It's possible, being the governor of Samaria, that he had, without leadership in Judah, taken, we're not told, but had taken over sort of leadership, default leadership maybe. But at any rate, I think Nehemiah coming in, none of these people want the welfare of Judah, and just as you pointed out there, as it specifically mentions. The Amorites had always lived, they had been pushed out to the outskirts, more to the deserts, from the sort of lush land there on the other side of the Jordan that they had inhabited. And with Judah gone, you see, they're able to take advantage of that absence. Samaria's taking advantage of that absence. These Arabian tribes taking advantage of that absence. So they're looking at competition here. And they want to stop that at all costs. What are some of the things that they did, Trevor, to try to get in the way of the efforts?
Well, I think as Travis mentioned earlier, I think maybe you said this as well, is that one of the first things they go to do is just trying to discourage them through saying this is something that they can't do, they can't succeed at this. Are you trying to rebel against the king? So, planting some doubt associated with that, and then just using, the tools of scoffing and scorn. And I couldn't help but think of John 3:20, where he talks about that everyone who loves the light comes to the light, and their deeds may be seen and may be manifest. When people have struggles or questions or there's some kind of issue, there is no reluctance to bring things out into the light where they can be seen, to see the truth and deal with it. This is a very dishonest tactic that they're using, as far as just using scoffing and scorn and things like that. And as we go through the book, we see them continuing to do other things that are like that as well, that are very devious and malicious as they're trying to go through it. So eventually they build up to the point where they organize some of the Arabs and some of the Ammonites and even some of the Ashdodites. So I would assume that's either people that moved back into that land of the Philistines or maybe some remnant of the Philistines there. But they organize those people and they get ready to attack them while they're trying to rebuild. And so, and as the book progresses, we see several just a little vague, not vague, but very, brief allusions to the fact that there are things that are continuing to go on, multiple letters that are being passed to Nehemiah that are either threatening or that they're, maybe using innuendo to try to accuse him of things, or multiple times they try to lure him out into the city or into the wilderness where he'll be vulnerable and they can kill him. Another time they try to lure him into the temple where he was not allowed to go. And then that would be something they could accuse him of sin. And so they're constantly using different things like that. Other thing that's interesting to me about that is Paul mentions to Titus about having good behavior such that the people who reproach you are ashamed. They have nothing evil to say against you. And that's one of the things I think you see about Nehemiah is they cannot make any of these accusations stick to him because of his character. But we'll talk more about that. But that's some of the things that they're using to try to get at him, various accusations as well as some very subtle things, but also direct violence and attacks as well.
Yeah, and that's really something that's new. Up to this point, we've seen opposition. We saw it with Zerubbabel and Jeshua, but the opposition was political. It was intrigue. Here, they're willing to actually get weapons out, willing to actually make threats of taking life. And so it goes further. What's interesting, though, is where mere intrigue worked the first time, even going all the way to violence doesn't work this time. And so Nehemiah is just much more determined, I think, than previous leaders at this point. Well, the people organized, and Jason, tell us a little bit about the organization when they got together to build the organization, and then how long it took. What do we see there?
Well, we see, as Trevor's already mentioned, they had a mind to work. They already said, "Let us arise and build." They got to it. They put their hands to good work back in chapter 2. So the way they went about that is they divided the wall and the gates into sections and by families. Each family had a section of wall that they were or a gate that they were to work on. And they all worked together at the same time. And they did this in a vigorous way. They worked together very hard. And it's interesting to me, you think of it sometimes as you read through this. And as you read through chapter 3 and it lays out each family and their work, you kind of have sometimes I think that they're working, this group is working and this group is working, but everybody's working side by side at the same time, all at the same time. And so if you think of it, sometimes you forget, or at least I do, that they're actually, all this is going on all at the same time. And all of these people are all working together really, really hard and vigorously all at the same time. But I think an interesting fact is brought out in verse 5 when it talks about the Tekoites, when he talks about the nobles to the Tekoites did not support or put their necks to the work of their masters. For whatever reason there, I think it's obviously brought out to talk about these Tekoites or the nobles of these Tekoites because obviously they didn't feel like they needed to work. And are too good to do this work. So they're called out here for whatever reason. All these other people are mentioned through chapter 3 for all the work that they're doing, but these are called out here to say that they weren't. And for whatever reason, it's here. But I think it's interesting that they were called out there for that. But whatever reason they are, what greater work could they have been doing that they weren't? But they were called out there. But again, you know, we see in chapter 4, verse 6, already mentioned, they had a mind or heart to do that work, and they did it very well and very hard. And some even had double portions of the wall that they fixed. They weren't just a single section. They had more sections that they repaired than just the one that they were given. They even worked to the point, as already talked about, being against the oppositions and against their enemies. They worked some with a weapon in one hand and carrying loads in the other. So looking out for their enemies. So there were different things that they faced. They were to the point they were going to get this done. And I like the description that starts chapter 3, where it says that Elisha the high priest arose with his brothers the priest and built the sheep gate. Then they consecrated and hung its doors, and then it continues on. And then at the very end of the book, it ends with chapter or verse 32, and it says, between the upper room and the corner of the sheep gate, the goldsmiths and the merchants carried out repairs. So they began at the sheep gate. It ends at the sheep gate, completing the entire wall. There was nothing left undone. It makes it a complete and entire wall, beginning with the sheep gate and ending with the sheep gate. And it was completed in 52 days and 7 weeks and 3 days, if you want to count that out. So it's impressive work, even though there's some out there that you look at that say you can add time to this or add years or whatever to 52 days. And they set their mind to get that work done, and they got it done.
Yeah. Yeah. And they did it, as you pointed out, while fending off attacks, while fending off enemies. Takeaways. One of the takeaways that I have from this section is the names being listed out. I'm always interested when lists of names are given. Not because I love reading genealogies. I, from the standpoint of, why are they there? Why is God listing out names for us? And one of the things that strikes me in this case is these names being recorded. Both for honor and dishonor, as Jason pointed out. And can you imagine? I know when my family, when we research and do genealogies, we pore over all sorts of documents. And there are certain documents, when you find a relative's name on those documents, it's a very exciting thing. And you say, my ancestor had a part in what, you know, name the event. And sometimes it's just exciting to see their names on the rolls, whatever they are. But can you imagine in generations to come, the families of these people being able to open up this record and say, my family built that part of the wall? That would be a great honor to that family. Can you imagine the lineage of the Tekoites that he mentioned, looking back and going, let's not bring that up. You know? And so for honor and dishonor, it allows people to look back and say, this is a family legacy. And so I appreciate that God sets that there for people to look back and to appreciate. And I, even though I'm not connected personally to those people, I want to appreciate that they were and what that means about us leaving a legacy. Let me go to Trevor and then Travis. Trevor, I said Trevor and Travis. I think that's what I said. Anyway, Trevor, what are some takeaways you take from this section of the rebuilding? What do you notice?
Well, just adding on to what you were just saying, another thing that I think that you get from the fact that he calls out these names both for honor and for dishonor is that emphasizes how important it is to be involved in this work and how much it means to God that people be involved and how much he looks down on it when people are not involved. And the other thing that kind of strikes me is a lot of times we make excuses as to why we can't do the work. Like maybe we're not the right person. We don't have the right skills. We don't have the right training, the right lineage. And when you go through this list, I think it breaks down all of those excuses. I think you even see one family that has nothing but daughters. There's no strong young men who are there to do all this hard work. He's there with his daughters, and they're doing their part as well. Yeah. So I think I'm there's something that all part. Of us can do. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You can identify with that, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yep, yep. So I think those are good lessons.
Yeah. Trevor, Travis, what about you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I see the leadership here. I see the leadership in Nehemiah, the great spiritual and physical. He was ready to go to battle, spiritually and physically, in this situation. So spiritually, he was praying. We understand that from, the previous verses and previous chapters that, He was constantly in prayer with God. And then also, he wasn't naive to think that there was that opposition around that was ready to destroy them physically, and he was prepared to go to battle. Not only that, but he brought people along with him. So as a leader, you know, it's just not him dictating and saying this is the way it's going to be, but he got those people on board to get the job done, and they got it done in a quick amount of time, 52 days, as was pointed out. So really the encouragement of the people and the encouragement as Nehemiah as a leader.
One more thing that I just bring out there that I think is, and Jason alluded to it, is the idea of building tools in one hand and weapons in the other. The idea that they didn't set down the work to fight the fight, and they didn't worry about the fight in order to do the work, building and fighting off enemies at the same time. Now, having said that, the other thing to note is that when enemies concentrated on one area, there was sort of a call to swarm. So there is a time where, okay, in this moment, not as a general rule, but in this moment, we're going to swarm to where the fight is, and then we're going to go right back to work. And I appreciate that those concepts there are very helpful to us. We don't want to be people who get zeroed in only one area of God's work, fighting one area of God's fight. There are times when there's emergencies, spiritual emergencies, but there's a work that we get back to. There's work in building in the kingdom that must always be the thing that we come back to again and again and again. Whatever may take us away for that for a moment, we come back to that. So anyway, I just love that part of the story. I love the lessons we can learn about leadership, about everybody being involved. It's really encouraging story. Well, it's not without discouragements. Just as Ezra came and he found people who were not completely committed, there are indicators all throughout this book that people wax and wane in their resolve and in their commitment. And so what problems other than the threats from the Jews' enemies that we've already talked about, internal problems, what does Nehemiah find there, Travis?
Yeah, we seem to see that picking up there in chapter 4, around verses 10 and 12, where it's not only the external, but it's the internal, the Jews that live among the people that are rebuilding the wall, that they have now come to those that are actually doing the work and trying to get them to return to their homes because of the impending danger. You know, it mentions there that they came 10 times. You know, that may be a synecdoche, or hyperbole of several times to try to persuade them to go back home and not to continue on with the work. It may be been out of, caution to try to help the brethren out, their brothers, or it may be as another opportunity to thwart the effort that's being done. So we see that there, and kind of, so we see again Nehemiah's reaction to that, right? He sets the people after their families around with weapons, and said to all of them in verse 14, he says, be not ye afraid of them. Remember the Lord, which is great and terrible, and fight for your brethren, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your houses. So that opportunity he took to encourage them to remember and to engage in that faith that they have in God, that God is on their side and he's going to help them out in this course of action. We see that also in there in chapter 5, beginning in chapter 5, that there was some type of famine, obviously around the area, some type of dearth, as King James renders it in verse 3. And the nobles and the rulers were exacting some type of usury on their brethren, right? They were having them, you know, some of these poor Jews were having to go and mortgage their homes, their lands, their vineyards, to buy the corn and the necessary items to feed their families. So much so that they even had to put their children, some of their children, into bondage. And when Nehemiah hears this, right, he immediately rebukes the nobles and rulers, and he calls an assembly, a great assembly, encouraging those who were doing this, the nobles and rulers, of exacting the usury, to restore this day immediately, right? Their lands, vineyards, olive yards, houses, and also a hundredth part of the money of the corn, the wine, and the oil. And the people said that they would do this, right? And that they would do this, and they had them actually make an oath in the presence of the priest and the people. And it says that they did that according to this promise there in chapter 5 and verse 13. So they had Jews that were living among them around that area that were trying to get them, to persuade them to go back home. And then they also had the nobles and rulers that were actually hurting them financially, right, with all their substance and that opposition there internally.
Yeah. And so, you know, here's something that's against the law anyway. The usury among brethren here was already against the law. But in a time such as this, it's even worse. You know, it's bad enough that it's against the law in the first place, but it's then in addition to take advantage, and to take advantage when it would seem that everybody ought to be on the same page. You know, everybody seems to be in other ways on the same page, but then there's some that what they see is an opportunity. And so we want to be careful about the same thing that, you know, I know some people have already gotten in trouble during, the current distress in our nation, where some people are seeing, all they're seeing is a financial opportunity. Hey, that's not where our mind should be. Our mind should be to help, to be an aid and a comfort to people, and not a cause for greater distress. And that's what these people were. Just as we see in Ezra, we see a favorable response. We don't see that sort of hardening of the heart and that stiffening of the neck. But we see people who are willing to sort of yield to that rebuke. And so there's some beauty in that. Through chapter 7, we have a census of those that have returned. Again, I think it's important to realize the value of those names being recorded, and people who would want to go back and see those names, see those families listed. But it's also record keeping. It's record keeping for the Jews. And I also think, though, that maybe there's some comparison here that you can make. You know, when we talk about going away into captivity and a remnant shall return, look at the numbers. Boy, we're nowhere near when we came into the promised land the first go round. Truly, this is a remnant. We're at a fraction of what the people were supposed to be, what they could have been. And so I think maybe that's illustrated here in this chapter as well. We come into chapter 8, and we have a reading of the law, and it's Ezra the scribe who's reading the law. And so he gets up and reads the law, and there's an interesting part here that often gets noted, where it tells us that he gave, the sense as he was reading. This is the preacher's authority for preaching 35 minutes on one verse. I assume that's what Ezra was doing. But he does. He gives context, presumably. He helps them to understand as he's reading. And I think that certainly that is valuable. But nevertheless, he reads the law, and what is the response of the people? How long does it take them to read the law, and how do they respond? And go into that a little bit there for us, Jason.
Well, you've already said there, you know, we're in chapter 8, and they tell Ezra to bring out the law, or the book of the law there, and he begins to read from it. It says that he read from it from morning until midday, and he's standing at a wooden podium that they have there at what the group is assembled there, and they've sat down in the area of the water gate. And when Ezra standing in front of the group, he opens the book of the law there in front of the people. It says that Ezra, the people stand up when he opens the law. And then he says, Ezra, bless the Lord. And the people said, amen, amen. And they lifted up their hands and they bowed low before to their faces to the ground and they worshiped the Lord. So they show a reverence there to the reading of the law. As you've already mentioned, as he's reading the law here, he and the other priests explained the law to the people. At some point in this reading of the first day that he's reading here, the people apparently begin to weep and be upset because of the reading of the law. And in verse 9, Nehemiah, the Ezra and the other Levites start to tell them that this day is holy to the Lord your God. Do not mourn and do not weep. The Levites explain to them again that this day is holy and do not be grieved, and to tell them to go and to eat and to drink and to celebrate. So the people depart and they go and they do that, and they come back a second day, and Ezra begins to read on the second day. And at this point, the people learn or hear of the Feast of Booths that's referred to from Leviticus chapter 23. And they make his proclamation, and they go out and they gather the supplies to make these booths that they were going to live in, and then continue on for 8 days or 7 days. And Ezra reads from the law for 7 days. And on the eighth day, they hold a solemn assembly, again, according to what was referred from Leviticus 23, referred to in the law. They hold that solemn assembly again on the eighth day. So they read the law for 7 days, and on the eighth day they hold their assembly. And in chapter 9, the people come together and they have fasting, the fasting sackcloth, and they have dirt on their heads, and they are separated from all foreigners, and they begin to confess their sins. And it says in verse 3 of chapter 9 that they stood in their place. They read from the book of the law of the Lord their God for a fourth of the day, and for another fourth they confessed, and they worshiped the Lord their God. So they're here, and they're confessing their sins before the Lord. And then the rest of the chapter 9, the Levites stood up and offered a powerful, powerful prayer before the Lord. We can't take time to read all of these verses through the end of chapter 9, but I encourage everybody here that's watching, and anybody, to read through these verses. And to what is said here, this prayer covers the history of the children of Israel from Abraham all the way up. And it shows the greatness of God. It shows the compassion of God and his willingness to repeatedly, listen to their outcries and repeatedly listen to them. And they recite this prayer. And at the end of that, they have a document or a covenant that they have drawn up. And in verse 38 says, because all of this, and it basically because of our past sins, because everything that we've done and the punishment that we received, the all that we've been through to prevent a recurrence of these things and similar conduct, the similar afflictions, to prevent all this that we've done, because of all this, we have this covenant that we're going to sign, that we're going to seal. And they do that. They seal it, and they seal it with the names of the leaders and the priests, beginning with Nehemiah, the governor. And then chapter 10 takes in with all those names of the ones who have sealed this document, with listing the sins there and the laws there.
Yeah. And so we've got another list of names of people who are, you know, bearing witness that we will hold to this covenant. I get a little bit of a reminder of, you know, Josiah, when the law was found and read to him, and his sort of horror at realizing how far away they were from the law. And I don't know what all's going. It's not exactly the same situation. I don't think the law has been lost. I do wonder if there's some, you know, a little bit of a similar situation with Zerubbabel and Jeshua, who came in and started a work, but then later prophets came and reinvigorated them to continue that work. Maybe Ezra, the same thing. He started, he began to set things back in order, and maybe that wanes a little bit, and here comes Nehemiah, and there's a reinvigoration with the building of the wall, and Ezra's involved in this work, where they step back to that work of let's be serious and let's go all the way, and not just stop at getting the most egregious offenses taken care of, but go all the way to set things back in place. And so as they make that covenant, they make that commitment, they sign their names to, mm-hmm. Travis, what are some of the specific things that they commit to refraining from?
Yeah, and I think that's a very important point that you just pointed out, right, is that they entered into an oath and a covenant with God to walk in his laws, to observe and do his commandments, his judgments and his statutes. And there in chapter 10 there, beginning in verse 28 and following, it talks about some of those specific things. And in verse 30, specifically not to allow the mixed marriages of other nations, right, with other nations. Verse 31, to keep the Sabbath holy, not to buy anything from the people of the land on any holy day, and leave that seventh year and exact of every gift and every debt during that time. Make those ordinances to give a third part of the shekel for the service of the house of our God. And we see more of that towards the service of the house of the God, that it may not be diminished and that it may be continually built up. Casting those lots among the priests, the Levites, and the people for the wood offering to bring into the house of God at the appointed times year by year. Verse 35 through 37, bringing those first fruits of the ground, the fruit of all the trees, the firstborn of the sons, the cattle, the herds, and the flocks, of the dough, of the wine, the oil, and the tithes of our ground unto the Levites to have the tithes. And then finally in verses 38 and 39, that the priest, the son of Aaron, shall be with the Levites, and the Levites shall bring up the tithes unto the treasure house. And at the end of verse 39 says, we will not forsake the house of our God. So those promises there sealed by the covenant that they made with God at this time.
Yeah. And so they spell out just these several things, specific things. And I don't think this means that they didn't commit to keep the whole law, but it's just maybe these were some particular things where they had specifically fallen out, whether it be the Sabbath, certainly in the maintaining of the house of God and so forth. This had been an issue. Incidentally, one of the things that I've pointed out in during the return, idolatry is not mentioned. And I don't say that to suggest that idolatry was a problem. They weren't willing to get rid of it. I say that to suggest I think it wasn't a problem. In the return, we do not see the return of idolatry. What we do see is a consistent sort of chopping at the root of that tree. Maybe things that would lead to idolatry, for instance, the marrying of foreign wives, those things are continually attacked at the root and say, let's not even go there. Let's deal with this, at the front end. And so I think that's, worth noting, is that the sins are not the same sins that were at the end of the period of Judah going into captivity. But they're sins that maybe are at an earlier stage. They're still sins. But maybe now they recognize where those sins lead. And so they're stopping that sooner. Well, as is often the case, sometimes resolves, don't last. And so what does that look like? Trevor, what laws did they end up violating? And what did Nehemiah do in response to that?
Well, there's multiple different ones, but two of the ones that jump out are the ones that they had just been dealing with just previously in chapter 10 about the marrying the pagan women, and then customs associated with like the Sabbath. And one of the themes that jumps out, if I can make a comment about this, that it seems like the people have, as you said, they've not fallen back into idolatry, but they've lapsed into kind of like a compromise state where whether it's fellowshipping those that are around them that are, worldly, not of the same mindset, or if it's falling back into a more secular mindset, not keeping the Sabbath, trying to, setting up shop on the Sabbath day and selling their wares. And so Nehemiah has to shut the gates to keep out the people, and he has to chase them off even from the walls where they're not waiting, trying to come in. But it's amazing that they go back to marrying the foreign women and the foreign people. In chapter 13, verse 23, he says, "In those days, I also saw Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab, and half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah." So these are people who've lost their heritage. They've lost their uniqueness, their holiness, and their recognition as being the people of God. But they spoke according to the language of one or the other people. And at least in the New King James reading of Nehemiah's reaction is very powerful. It says, "So I contended with them and cursed them, struck some of them and pulled out their hair and made them swear by God, saying, 'You shall not give your daughters as wives to the son, to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons of yourselves.'" And then he reminds them of Solomon and his wisdom, and yet he sinned in this way. And then he says in verse 27, "Should we then hear of your doing all this great evil, transgressing against our God by marrying pagan women?" And I think one of the summary verses to your point is he talks about in verse 28, driving these people out, and then this is some of the people that they've been struggling with. Part of the reason they were so ingrained in the people is because they had married their way into the Jews. And so he drives them out in verse 28, Sanballat the Horonite. And then he says in verse 30, "Thus I cleanse them of everything pagan." And that seems to be kind of the theme of these last few chapters, is Nehemiah's incredible diligence to not say, "Well, hey, we've done a pretty good job. This is good enough. We didn't accomplish everything we wanted, but good." He's going to the last mile, to the very end, to make sure that he's cleansing them of everything pagan and restoring not just the nation, but the spiritual purity and drive of these people, that they understand how are and the responsibility they bear.
Yeah, and we're coming up on our time here, so we're going to have to be brief in our closing comments. But just one thing, based on what you said there, that you know, I think that noticing the difficulty and maybe messiness, the sort of the time it takes to accomplish restoration, and you can have successes along the way that don't mean your work's done. You know, it's a grand success when they get the walls built. And that's an encouraging part. In fact, it's the part we most remember about Nehemiah. Generally speaking, that's what we're referring to, the building of the walls. But we're not even halfway through the book yet, you know, or right at it. And we've got chapters to go. And those chapters are really maybe even the more difficult work that Nehemiah goes to, the work of pulling people's hair out, you know. You know, just trying to get them to come all the way back to God. Not just that sort of initial spurt that just fizzles out. But no, let's be serious. Let's be real about this commitment. Let's hold to it. Some other takeaways. I'll start with Jason and then we'll go to Travis.
Takeaways that I've got, quickly. I see throughout this book Nehemiah's strong faith and his trust in God, and no matter what hardship he faced, no matter the mocking or ridicule in the building of the wall, no matter facing of the people and stuff, just as Trevor was talking about, his always strong faith and his trust in God. And I think that faith is tremendously shown through his prayers to God in the first few chapters we've already talked about. His willingness to offer those prayers to God. And I think that's a strong, tremendous example for us, especially in the times that we're facing right now, to not lose our faith. I think this time we're facing right now can be a test on our faith. And we have to offer our prayers and get a stronger faith, in God. And then lastly, is God's law doesn't change. It didn't change from the time he gave it to Moses until this time that they returned and they read it from Ezra read it and they offered the covenant, and the law that we're under doesn't change. We're under a new covenant, and that law doesn't change no matter what happens, no matter the things that happen to us, no matter what people way they try to twist it or things they try to do. It doesn't change. God's law doesn't change, and what we're under now doesn't change.
Travis?
Yeah, a few takeaways as well. To add to what Jason was saying a little bit more is with Nehemiah, he saw a need. He saw a need among his brethren. He heard that need, and then he went and saw that, and he took action. He wasn't complacent about it. He didn't sit back, but he was proactive. And that is a great lesson for us when we see a need or hear of a need to take action and to help in with our brethren, more importantly, there. The wisdom that's displayed, secondly, the wisdom that is displayed by Nehemiah avoiding to go into battle. He saw, you know, he foresaw what was potentially going to take place there. And he had the wisdom not to go into the plains. The wisdom of the rulers and nobles, you know, they had the wisdom to, when Nehemiah rebuked them, to be quiet. And then when he spoke, to do what was recommended, and they did it, to have that wisdom there. And the Jews to follow the commandments of the Lord, the wisdom that they had there. Great encouragement from this book. Certainly the Jews rebuilding the wall, even at the threat that they have internally and externally, that people had a mind to work, and they were diligent in that work. And in chapter 8, we see that they had respect for God's word, when Ezra, read it to them, and they were attentive to that. And that is, certainly encouraging for us today. And really appreciate the opportunity to study this book.
Trevor, any final thoughts from you?
Yeah, sure. I think as Travis and Jason said, this fantastic book, Nehemiah is a tremendous character. One of the things that to me stands out is his tremendous love for the people and for God. And I think that's evidenced in, first of all, the fact that there was all these different issues and trials and struggles and people pushing back, and Nehemiah kept pushing through. And that's an evidence to how much he cared, how much he loved the people, how much he loved God. And so tremendous compassion. And you see that in the keeping of the governor's provisions. He didn't tax the people. He didn't take opportunity to buy land and build fortune. Instead, what you see him is him opening up his own resources and feeding people and taking care of people. And so when it was a very difficult time, he actually opened himself up to help people directly, even beyond all the leadership sacrifices that he was making. And then just quick miscellaneous comment about, I love the picture of the people with both the tool in one hand, you know, working in one, and then the sword or the spear in the other. And one of the things that's interesting to me is because they were prepared and because they were very proactive in following Nehemiah's leadership, as Travis pointed out, then actually the attack never came. And so I think that's a good lesson for us, that if we're real about the challenges that are in front of us, and if we take appropriate actions, not saying that the attacks won't come, but oftentimes the attacks do not come or at the same severity if we prepare ourselves. And even if they do come, then we're prepared. Yeah. And we can rally, as you said.
Yeah, well, listen, I really appreciate you guys joining me. It's been a good study. And I hope it's been helpful to everybody listening in. We did have one comment I wanted to bring up. Rachel Neely brought up the difference in language. And in fact, this is in Nehemiah chapter 8 when Ezra gave the sense. It says in the New American Standard, he translated. The definition there gives explaining. But one of the things was brought up there at the end is the people are speaking different language. And one of the things, they may have forgotten the language of their people and needed Ezra to put it back into a language that they could understand. Now, having said all that, I'm going to hold to this as my authority to expound on verses when I want to. But I do think that that's probably part of that, is that the explaining involves that they've lost connection. And so I appreciate Rachel bringing that up. But at any rate, very encouraging book, encouraging study. I appreciate you guys being here with us again. For everybody watching, Sunday afternoon, and I'll be posting times soon, probably around 2 o'clock, we'll have a study on Malachi. So that'll be our last story before we go into that period of silence. We study that period of silence. We're not going to a period of silence, but we'll be studying that period of silence. So we invite you to join us back for those studies coming up. One more thing to mention is starting next week, we'll be beginning a study of the book of Isaiah, and Trevor's going to be leading us in that study. We're going to have, as long as the quarantine goes on, we're going to continue to have studies like this, and he'll be leading those starting next week. And so we encourage you to join us for that as well. Well, I appreciate it, guys, and hope everybody will join us for our next study, and we will see you then.